Intruder in the Dust by William Faulkner. Chapter 1. It was just noon that Sunday morning when the sheriff reached the jail with Lucas Beecham, though the whole town, the whole county too for that matter, had known since the night before that Lucas had killed a white man. He was there, waiting. He was the first one, standing, lounging, trying to look occupied, or at least innocent, under the shed in front of the closed blacksmith's shop across the street from the jail, where his uncle would be less likely to see him if, or rather when, he crossed the square toward the post office for the 11 o'clock mail. Because he knew Lucas Beecham, too. As well, that is, as any white person knew him. Better than any, maybe, unless it was Carruthers Edmonds, on whose place Lucas lived 17 miles from town, because he had eaten a meal in Lucas's house. It was in the early winter, 4 years ago. He had been only 12 then, and it had happened this way. Edmonds was a friend of his uncle. They had been in school at the same time at the State University, where his uncle had gone after he came back from Harvard and Heidelberg to learn enough law to get himself chosen county attorney. And the day before, Edmonds had come into town to see his uncle on some county business and had stayed the night with them, and at supper that evening, Edmonds had said to him, "Come out home with me tomorrow and go rabbit hunting." And then to his mother, "I'll send him back in tomorrow afternoon. I'll send a boy along with him while he's out with his gun." And then to him again, "He's got a good dog." "He's got a boy," his uncle said, and Edmonds said, "Does his boy run rabbits too?" And his uncle said, "We'll promise he won't interfere with yours." So the next morning, he and Alexander went home with Edmonds. It was cold that morning, the first winter cold snap. The hedgerows were rimed and stiff with frost, and the standing water in the roadside drainage ditches was skimmed with ice, and even the edges of the running water in the 9-mile branch glinted fragile and scintillant like fairy glass. And from the first farmyard they passed, and then again and again and again, came the windless tang of wood smoke, and they could see in the backyards the black iron pots already steaming, while women in the sunbonnets, still of summer, or men's old felt hats and long men's overcoats, stoked wood under them, and the men with croaker sack aprons tied with wire over their overalls whetted knives are already moved about the pens where hogs grunted and squealed, not quite startled, not alarmed, but just alerted as though sensing already, even though only dimly, their rich and imminent destiny. By nightfall, the whole land would be hung with their spectral, intact, tallow-colored, empty carcasses, immobilized by the heels in attitudes of frantic running, as though full tilt at the center of the earth. And he didn't know how it happened. The boy, one of Edmund's tenant's sons, older and larger than Alexander, who in his turn was larger than he, although they were the same age, was waiting at the house with the dog. A true rabbit dog. Some hound. A good deal of hound. Maybe mostly hound. Red bone and black and tan with maybe a little pointer somewhere once. A potlicker. A nigger dog which it took but one glance to see had an affinity, a rapport with rabbits, such as people said Negroes had with mules. And Alexander already had his tapstick. One of the heavy nuts which bolt railroad rails together, driven onto a short length of broom handle, which Alexander could throw whirling end over end at a running rabbit pretty near as accurately as he could shoot the shotgun. And Alexander and Edmund's boy with tapsticks, and he with the gun, they went down through the park and across a pasture to the creek where Edmund's boy knew the foot log was, and he didn't know how it happened. Something a girl might have been expected and even excused for doing, but nobody else. Halfway over the footlog and not even thinking about it, who would walk the top rail of a fence many a time twice that far, when all of a sudden the known familiar sunny winter earth was upside down and flat on his face, and still holding the gun he was rushing not away from the earth, but away from the bright sky. And he could remember still the thin, bright tinkle of the breaking ice, and how he didn't even feel the shock of the water, but only of the air when he came up again. He had dropped the gun, too, so he had to dive, submerge again to find it, back out of the icy air into the water which as yet felt neither cold or not, and where even his sodden garments, Boots and thick pants and sweater and hunting coat didn't even feel heavy, but just slow, and found the gun and tried again for bottom, then thrashed one-handed to the bank and treading water and clinging to a willow branch, he reached the gun up until someone took it. Edmund's boy, obviously, since at that moment, Alexander rammed down at him the end of a long pole, almost a log whose first pass struck his feet out from under him and sent his head under again, and almost broke his hold on the willow until a voice said, "Get the pole out of his way so he can get up." Just a voice. Not because it couldn't be anybody else but either Alexander or Edmund's boy, but because it didn't matter whose. Climbing out now with both hands among the willows, the skim ice crinkling and tinkling against his chest, his clothes like soft, cold lead which he didn't move in but seemed rather to mount into, like a poncho or a tarpaulin. Up the bank until he saw 2 feet in gumboots which were neither Edmund's boy's nor Alexander's, and then the legs, the overalls rising out of them, and he climbed on and stood up and saw a Negro man with an axe on his shoulder, in a heavy sheep-lined coat and a broad, pale felt hat such as his grandfather had used to wear, looking at him. And that was when he saw Lucas Beecham for the first time that he remembered, or rather, for the first time, because you didn't forget Lucas Beecham. Gasping, shaking, and only now feeling the shock of the cold water, he looked up at the face which was just watching him without pity, commiseration, or anything else, not even surprise. Just watching him, whose owner had made no effort whatever to help him up out of the creek, had in fact ordered Alexander to desist with the pole which had been the one token toward help that anybody had made. A face which in his estimation might have been under 50 or even 40, except for the hat and the eyes, and inside a Negro's skin, but that was all even to a boy of 12, shaking with cold and still panting from shock and exertion, because what looked out of it had no pigment at all, not even the white man's lack of it, not arrogant, not even scornful, just intractable and composed. Then Edmund's boy said something to the man, speaking a name. Something Mr. Lucas. And then he knew who the man was, remembering the rest of the story, which was a piece, a fragment of the country's chronicle which few, if any, knew better than his uncle. How the man was son of one of old Carruthers McCaslin's, Edmund's great-grandfather's slaves, who had been not just old Carruthers' slave, but his son, too. Standing and shaking steadily now for what seemed to him another whole minute while the man stood looking at him with nothing whatever in his face. Then the man turned, speaking not even back over his shoulder, already walking, not even waiting to see if they heard, let alone were going to obey. "Come on to my house." "I'll go back to Mr. Edmund's," he said. The man didn't look back. He didn't even answer. "Tote his gun, Joe," he said. So he followed, with Edmund's boy and Alexander following him, in single file along the creek toward the bridge and the road. Soon he had stopped shaking. He was just cold and wet now, and most of that would go if he just kept moving. They crossed the bridge. Ahead now was the gate where the drive went up through the park to Edmund's house. It was almost a mile. He would probably be dry and warm both by the time he got there, and he still believed he was going to turn in at the gate, and even after he knew that he wasn't, or anyway hadn't, already beyond it now, he was still telling himself the reason was that, although Edmunds was a bachelor and there were no women in the house, Edmunds himself might refuse to let him out of the house again until he could be returned to his mother. Still telling himself this even after he knew that the true reason was that he could no more imagine himself contradicting the man striding on ahead of him than he could his grandfather. Not from any fear of nor even the threat of reprisal, but because like his grandfather, the man striding ahead of him was simply incapable of conceiving himself by a child contradicted and defied. So he didn't even check when they passed the gate. He didn't even look at it, and now they were in no well-used, tended lane leading to tenant or servant quarters and marked by walking feet, but a savage gash, half gully and half road, mounting a hill with an air solitary, independent, and intractable too, And then he saw the house, the cabin, and remembered the rest of the story. The legend. How Edmund's father had deeded to his Negro first cousin and his heirs in perpetuity the house and the 10 acres of land it sat in, an oblong of earth set forever in the middle of the 2,000-acre plantation like a postage stamp in the center of an envelope. The paintless wooden house, the paintless picket fence whose paintless, latchless gate the man need open still without stopping or once looking back, and he following, and Alexander and Edmund's boy following him, strode on into the yard. It would have been grassless even in summer. He could imagine it, completely bare, no weed, no sprig of anything, the dust each morning swept by some of Lucas's women folks with a broom made of willow switches bound together into an intricate series of whorls and overlapping loops which, as the day advanced, would be gradually and slowly defaced by the droppings and the cryptic three-toed prints of chickens, like, remembering it now at 16, a terrain in miniature out of the age of the great lizards, the four of them walking in what was less than walk because its surface was dirt too, yet more than path, the foot-packed strip running plumb line straight between two borders of tin cans and empty bottles and shards of china and earthenware set into the ground, up to the paintless steps and the paintless gallery, along whose edge sat more cans, but larger, empty gallon buckets which had once contained molasses, or perhaps paint and worn-out water, or milk pails, and 1 5-gallon can for kerosene with its top cut off, and half of what had once been somebody's, Edmund's, without doubt, kitchen hot water tank, sliced long ways like a banana, out of which flowers had grown last summer, and from which the dead stalks and the dried and brittle tendrils still leaned and drooped. And beyond this, the house itself, gray and weathered, and not so much paintless as independent of and intractable to paint, so that the house was not only the one possible continuation of the stern, untended road, but was its crown, too, as the carven ailanthus leaves are the Greek column's capital. Nor did the man pause yet, up the steps and across the gallery, and opened the door and entered, and he and then Edmund's boy and Alexander followed. A hall dim, even almost dark after the bright outdoors, and already he could smell that smell which he had accepted without question all his life as being the smell always of the places where people with any trace of Negro blood live, as he had that all people named Mallison or Methodists. Then a bedroom, a bare, worn, quite clean, paintless, rugless floor, in one corner and spread with a bright patchwork quilt, a vast, shadowy tester bed which had probably come out of old Carruthers McCaslin's house, and a battered, cheap Grand Rapids dresser, and then, for the moment, no more, or at least little more. Only later would he notice, or remember that he had seen, the cluttered mantel on which sat a kerosene lamp hand-painted with flowers, and a vase filled with spills of twisted newspaper, and above the mantel the colored lithograph of a 3-year-old calendar in which Pocahontas, in the quilled, fringed buckskins of a Sioux or Chippewa chief, stood against a balustrade of Italian marble above a garden of formal cypresses, and shadowy in the corner opposite the bed, a chromo portrait of 2 people framed heavily in gold-painted wood on a gold-painted easel. But he hadn't seen that at all yet, because that was behind him, and all he now saw was the fire. The clay-daubed fieldstone chimney in which a half-burned backlog glowed and smoldered in the gray ashes, and beside it, in a rocking chair, something which he thought was a child until he saw the face. And then he did pause long enough to look at her, because he was about to remember something else his uncle had told him about, or at least in regard to Lucas Beecham. And looking at her, he realized for the first time how old the man actually was. Must be. A tiny, old, almost doll-sized woman, much darker than the man, in a shawl and an apron, her head bound in an immaculate white cloth on top of which sat a painted straw hat bearing some kind of ornament. But he couldn't think what it was his uncle had said or told him, and then he forgot that he had remembered even the having been told. Sitting in the chair himself now, squarely before the hearth where Edmund's boy was building up the fire with split logs and pine slivers, and Alexander squatting, tugged off the wet boots and then his trousers, and standing he got out of the coat and sweater and his shirt, both of them having to dodge around and past and under the man who stood straddled on the hearth, his back to the fire and the gum boots and the hat, and only the sheepskin coat removed. And then the old woman was beside him again, less tall than he and Alexander, even at 12, with another of the bright patchwork quilts on her arm. "Strip off," the man said. "No," he said. "Strip off," the man said. So he stripped off the wet union suit, too, and then he was in the chair again in front of the now bright and swirling fire, enveloped in the quilt like a cocoon, enclosed completely now in that unmistakable odor of Negroes. That smell which, if it were not for something that was going to happen to him within a space of time measurable now in minutes, he would have gone to his grave never once pondering, speculating if perhaps that smell were really not the odor of a race, nor even actually of poverty, but perhaps of a condition, an idea, a belief, an acceptance, a passive acceptance by them themselves of the idea that being Negroes they were not supposed to have facilities to wash properly or often, or even to wash, bathe often, even without the facilities to do it with. That in fact it was a little to be preferred that they did not. But the smell meant nothing now or yet. It was still an hour yet before the thing would happen, and it would be 4 years more before he would realize the extent of its ramifications and what it had done to him, and he would be a man grown before he would realize, admit that he had accepted it. So he just smelled it and then dismissed it because he was used to it. He had smelled it off and on all his life and would continue to. Who had spent a good part of that life in Paralese, Alexander's mother's cabin in their backyard where he and Alexander played in the bad weather when they were little, and Paralee would cook whole meals for them halfway between two meals at the house, and he and Alexander would eat them together, the food tasting the same to each. He could not even imagine an existence from which the odor would be missing to return no more. He had smelled it forever. He would smell it always. It was a part of his inescapable past. It was a rich part of his heritage as a Southerner. He didn't even have to dismiss it. He just no longer smelled it at all, as the pipe smoker long since never did smell at all the cold pipe reek which is as much a part of his clothing as their buttons and buttonholes, sitting, drowsing a little even in the warm, huddled rankness of the quilt, rousing a little when he heard Edmund's boy and Alexander get up from where they had been squatting against the wall and leave the room. But not much. Sinking again into the quilt's warm reek while there stood over him still, back to the fire and hands clasped behind him, and except for the clasped hands and the missing axe and the sheep-lined coat, exactly as when he had looked up out of the creek and seen him first. The man in the gum boots and the faded overalls of a Negro, but with a heavy gold watch chain looping across the bib of the overalls, and shortly after they entered the room he had been conscious of the man turning and taking something from the cluttered mantle and putting it into his mouth, and later he had seen what it was. A gold toothpick, such as his own grandfather had used. And the hat was a worn handmade beaver such as his grandfather had paid $30 and $40 apiece for. Not set, but raked slightly above the face, pigmented like a Negro's, but with a nose high in the bridge and even hooked a little, and what looked out through it or from behind it, not black nor white either, not arrogant at all and not even scornful, just intolerant, inflexible, and composed. Then Alexander came back with his clothes, dried now and still almost hot from the stove, and he dressed, stamping into his stiffened boots. Edmund's boy, squatting again against the wall, was still eating something from his hand, and he said, "I'll have my dinner at Mr. Edmund's." The man neither protested nor acquiesced. He didn't stir, He was not even looking at him. He just said, inflexible and calm, "She done already dished it up now." And he went on past the old woman who stood aside from the door to let him pass, into the kitchen. An oilcloth-covered table set in the bright, sunny square of a southern window where, he didn't know how he knew it since there were no signs, traces, soiled plates to show it, Edmund's boy and Alexander had already eaten, and sat down and ate in his turn of what obviously was to be Lucas's dinner. Collard greens, a slice of side meat fried in flour, big, flat, pale, heavy, half-cooked biscuits, a glass of buttermilk. Nigger food, too. Accepted and then dismissed also because it was exactly what he had expected. It was what Negroes ate, obviously because it was what they liked, what they chose. Not at 12. He would be a man grown before he experienced his first amazed dubiety at this, that out of their long chronicle this was all they had had a chance to learn to like except the ones who ate out of white folks' kitchens, but that they had elected this out of all eating because this was their palates and their metabolism. Afterward, 10 minutes later, and then for the next 4 years, he would be trying to tell himself that it was the food which had thrown him off. But he would know better. His initial error, misjudgment, had been there all the time, not even needing to be abetted by the smell of the house and the quilt in order to survive what had looked out, and not even at him, just looked out from the man's face. Rising at last and with the coin, the half-dollar already in his hand going back into the other room. When he saw for the first time, because he happened to be facing it now, the gold-framed portrait group on its gold easel, and he went to it, stooping to peer at it in its shadowy corner where only the gold leaf gleamed, before he knew he was going to do it. It had been retouched, obviously. From behind the round, faintly prismatic glass dome, as out of a Sears crystal ball, there looked back at him again the calm, intolerant face beneath the swaggering rake of the hat, a tieless, starched collar clipped to a white, starched shirt with a collar button shaped like a snake's head and almost as large, the watch chain looped now across a broadcloth vest inside a broadcloth coat, and only the toothpick missing. And beside him, the tiny doll-like woman in another painted straw hat and a shawl. That is, it must have been the woman, though it looked like nobody he had ever seen before, and then he realized it was more than that. There was something ghastly, almost intolerably wrong about it or her. When she spoke and he looked up, the man still standing straddled before the fire and the woman sitting again in the rocking chair in its old place, almost in the corner, and she was not looking at him now, and he knew she had never looked at him since he re-entered. Yet she said, "That's some more of Lucas's doings." And he said, "What?" And the man said, "Molly don't like it because the man that made it took her head rag off." And that was it. She had hair. It was like looking at an embalmed corpse through the hermetic glass lid of a coffin, and he thought, Molly. Of course. Because he remembered now what it was his uncle had told him about Lucas, or about them. He said, "Why did he take it off?" "I told him to," the man said. "I didn't want no field nigger picture in the house." And he walked toward them now, putting the fist holding the half-dollar back into his pocket and scooping the dime and the 2 nickels, all he had, into the palm with it, saying, "You came from town. My uncle knows you. Lawyer Gavin Stevens." "I remember your mama, too," she said. "She used to be Miss Maggie Dandridge." "That was my grandmother," he said. "My mother's name was Stevens, too," and extended the coins. And in the same second in which he knew she would have taken them, he knew that only by that one irrevocable second was he forever now too late, forever beyond recall, standing with the slow, hot blood, as slow as minutes themselves, up his neck and face, forever with his dumb hand open, and on it the four shameful fragments of milled and minted dross, until at last the man had something that at least did the office of pity. "What's that for?" the man said, not even moving, not even tilting his face downward to look at what was on his palm. For another eternity, and only the hot, dead, moveless blood, until at last it ran to rage, so that at least he could bear the shame. And watched his palm turn over, not flinging the coins, but spurning them downward, ringing onto the bare floor, bouncing, and one of the nickels even rolling away in a long, swooping curve with a dry, minute sound like the scurry of a small mouse. And then his voice, "Pick it up!" And still nothing. The man didn't move, hands clasped behind him, looking at nothing. Only the rush of the hot, dead, heavy blood out of which the voice spoke, addressing nobody. "Pick up his money." And he heard and saw Alexander and Edmund's boy reach and scurry among the shadows near the floor. "Give it to him," the voice said, and saw Edmund's boy drop his two coins into Alexander's palm, and felt Alexander's hand fumble the four of them at his own dropped hand and then into it. "Now go on and shoot your rabbit," the voice said, "and stay out of that creek."